You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, August 17th, 2016, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Evening, folks.
Jay, how was your vacation and birthday?
It was quite well. It was good. It was a very hot week in New England.
Oh my God, it was like
it was
Africa
nasty.
Hot. I was at a beach house for a few days, and it was really hot in a beach house for a few days. But we had a great time. I will admit, I went LARPing last weekend.
Oh my God.
And so did Steve and Evan.
The height of geekery.
Yeah, pretty much. No, the height of geekery is this. It's going to a LARP and then playing D&D in your cabin.
Okay.
That is not
We never did,
but we did catch people doing that. Not this weekend, but previously.
It's
but
almost indescribable.
Yeah. Yep.
Indescribable.
And I am so old that I forgot how old I was.
This is a good way to remind yourself.
It did.
I'm at that birthday? Point, I think, where I calculate from my birth year.
Yeah, but I'm, you know, it's like I'm just whatever. I don't care anymore, you know. So I just for some reason thought I was turning 49 this year. I actually turned 48, and when I told my wife, "Wow, one more year until 50," she's like, "What? What the hell are you talking about?" And then she's like, doing the math with me, and I'm like, "Oh my God!" And she goes, "I just gave you a year of life."
You guys, I had a really fun weekend.
Mm-hmm. What'd you do?
Did you LARP?
I did not LARP, but on Saturday, we have a friend named Stella, and she's a very bright girl. She's like a profoundly gifted young woman. She's 11 years old, and she just got accepted to college.
Cool.
So, yeah. So her parents decided to throw her an elementary school dropout party at the Magic Castle.
So oh, that was really nice.
Fun. Oh, very cool. Yeah. Now, you've been there, right?
I'd been there before, but this time we had brunch. We got to see four different shows. One of them was by this really gifted 16-year-old magician who did a show that was quantum physics themed, and Sean Carroll came, and he didn't know. And he asked somebody to volunteer, and Sean Carroll came up and volunteered in his routine. And his mother was filming it for his MIT college application. So that was a pretty special day for him, too. Yeah.
So wait, this girl is starting college at 12 years old? Is that what you're telling
11.
Me? 11. At 11.
What?
11. She's in the early entrance program at a local university here.
I
she's
think
basically,
so.
Yeah, she's basically just one of these girls she's done everything she needs to do. She's gone through all of the school courses, obviously not in class, in homeschooling, but her parents don't homeschool her. They hire tutors and they hire all the right people. And she plays soccer with friends her age and she does a lot of social things, but she's just so profoundly gifted that she basically was getting bored and they had to figure out what the next step for her was. She was auditing classes at Caltech last semester. She took biochemistry at Caltech and she wasn't allowed to take lab because she wasn't old enough. They didn't trust her with the lab equipment.
She can reach the counter.
I know. She has her own dissection kit that has like extra small gloves and her own scalpels and stuff. It's pretty crazy,
awesome.
But she's very, very gifted. And
what does she want to do?
She wants to be a geneticist. She's really into genetics. She
Thank
jokes
goodness.
All the time when people ask, because they're like, you must not have a normal childhood and your parents must be so overbearing. Her parents are awesome. Her dad's a lawyer. Her mom's a celebrity makeup artist. And she's always like, oh, I don't have a tiger mom. I'm a tiger kitten. Like, I love that.
She's self-motivated.
She's very self-motivated. She's just one of those people who's just profoundly motivated and just very, very bright. So
wow.
I'm glad that she's, that she's not. And it was really fun at Magic Castle because, of course, she has a lot of friends that are our age, nerdy people that she met at the museum. But she also had plenty of friends that were her age who were also very gifted. And it was cool hanging out with a big group of super nerdy kids who really celebrate their nerdiness.
Well, Bob, maybe she one day she's going to be a forgotten or not so forgotten superhero of science.
Sure. But not this week, because this week for Forgotten Superheroes of Science, I'm talking about Janet Rowley, 1925 to 2013, who was a geneticist and who was the first person to link chromosomal abnormalities to leukemia and other cancers. Rowley entered university at 15, you know, not quite 12, but 15 is still impressive. She was clearly gifted. And she received her bachelor's degree at 19. And when she went to the university's medical school, she actually had to wait 9 months to enroll because at that time, the school had already accepted their quota of women for the year. And that quota was 3 in a class of 65. So she was the fourth one, and she had to wait 9 months because of that quota. 3 out of 65. That's just incredible. Rowley was described in the New York Times in 2011 as the matriarch of modern cancer genetics, and with good reason. She found that abnormal genetic swaps between two chromosomes, something that's called translocations, were often the cause of cancer and not merely a consequence of it, which is what the leading idea was at that time. She started finding more swaps between other chromosomes, each causing, you know, different types of leukemia and other cancers. But now today there's hundreds of these translocations that have been identified. She basically established cancer as a genetic disease. Her findings led to treatments, for example, Gleevec, which treats chronic myelogenous leukemia, Steve?
Myelogenous
leukemia. Okay, that's what I thought. What was my second choice? That's CML. For people that had CML decades ago, diagnosis used to be 3 to 5 years. You would have 3 to 5 years living. Now, because of some of the work that she did, now 90% of them are cured and live normal lives. So amazing impact. So remember Janet Rowley. Mention her to your friends, perhaps when discussing quinacrine fluorescence and gem sustaining.
Like you do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, the field of genetics, you know, inducing cancers, predisposition to cancers, the genetic changes that cause cancer is huge. Indeed. Still a very active area of research, and that is driving a lot of our progress in treating cancers. It's a huge field.
Right. Not only what's causing it, but also how to treat it. And she and Janet Rowley was a huge pioneer in that field.
Absolutely. All right, Jay, you're going to start us off with the news items by telling us about chemtrails.
I am. Chemtrails, we've all heard of them, but what the heck are they? For those of you who don't know, complete bullshit. Yeah, they're first, don't confuse chemtrails with contrails. Contrails are a combination of frozen water vapor and aircraft engine exhaust, right? So this is all that you are actually seeing that comes out the back of a jet when it's flying at high altitude. The water vapor freezes because it's very low temperature up there at the, you know, cruising altitude 5 to 10 miles or 8 to 16 kilometers above the surface of the Earth. Chemtrails are also not cloud seeding or crop dusting. The chemtrail conspiracy theory, people have also referred to chemtrails as covert geoengineering, is an unproven theory that high-flying aircraft deliberately spray chemicals or biological agents into the atmosphere for a host of evil purposes. What evil purposes, you ask, Kara? Well, how about psychological manipulation, human population control, weather modification, biological or chemical warfare?
Now, how would that work, Jay?
Well, let me explain it to you, because the rabbit hole begins here. The chemtrail conspiracy theorists, they also claim that chemtrails are causing respiratory illness and other various health problems and damage to the environment. Chemtrails are the product of something called SLAP, or Secret Large-Scale Atmospheric Spraying Program. And I would have the secret organization called CRAP, C-R-A-P. That stands for Chemtrails Are Really Pathetic.
Jay, would you describe yourself as anti-SLAP?
I'm anti-SLAP. Bob, good job.
Hey, way to tie it all in.
To summarize, what we have here is extreme anomaly hunting, where those who believe in chemtrails claim that contrails do not last as long as chemtrails in the atmosphere, or that broken or colored contrails are not normal. You know, they could take on swirls and shapes and things like that. The problem is that chemtrail believers have zero scientific evidence backing their claims, of course, and there's no proof that the lines that they see in the sky are full of harmful, deliberately sprayed chemicals. Not to mention that, you know, how many thousands of people would all have to know about this conspiracy and be quiet about it? So I called up our friend Joe Anderson, who has been a professional airline pilot for the last 12 years, and Joe and I had a real awesome conversation tonight. We talked about the TV show Stranger Things, among other things, which is a freaking awesome TV show, especially if you're, you know, you're in the age range to appreciate it. But Joe and I came up just from like a pilot's perspective and from the mathematical perspective. So think about this. First of all, pilots have to know their airplanes really well. They don't just have a vague idea of the airplane that they're flying. They have an extraordinarily detailed understanding of the aircraft. So they would notice weird activity in and around the aircraft, right? Wouldn't they? Don't you think they would? Don't you think they'd know that
line? Unless they're in on the conspiracy.
Exactly. Interesting. Great point, Kara. So let's do a little mathematical fun here real quick. If all the pilots were in the know, then it would be ridiculous to think that they're all keeping it quiet, because there's an estimated 60,000 professional airline pilots in the United States alone, right?
Yeah, it's probably active, and then a bunch of retired ones as well.
Oh, yeah.
So even
yeah.
if a quarter of them, whatever, I'm just pulling numbers out of my butt at this point, but let's say a quarter of them were in the know, that's a huge number. Tens of thousands of pilots would have to be in on it and keeping it perfectly quiet. Now, let's say...
Right, Jay. Real quick, though. This ties into a very interesting talk we gave months ago that described grand conspiracy theories based on how many people knew about it. And then from there, they extrapolated how long it would take to fall apart. The more people involved... So for something like this, chemtrail conspiracy, with so many people, it would literally fall apart like within months, if not... even days, weeks, you know, people would be coming out saying, they made me do this, here's the proof, blah, blah, blah. So it's so ridiculous.
So you have the first idea is all the pilots know about it and they're quiet. The second idea is none of the pilots know about it and they all would have to be, the chemtrails would have to be hidden from that many people. Ridiculous, right? But let's not forget the ground crew, which greatly outnumber the pilots. So we're not just talking about 60,000 pilots in the United States as an example, but there's probably 10 to 1, 20 to 1 ground crew involved with an airplane taking off, including the guy that drives the food up to the airplane. You know, like all of those people would have to be either completely blocked from it or completely indoctrinated. Back to the whole point to this news item, which is actually the real interesting thing here, is there was a survey. So in an international survey, 17% of the general public say that they believe in chemtrails in some degree. So to put that theory to rest, Christine Shearer, Mick West, Ken Calderia, and Stephen J. Davis published a paper on August 10th, 2016, where they surveyed two groups of expert atmospheric chemists with expertise in condensation trails and geochemists working on atmospheric deposition of dust and pollution.
What do they know?
They were asked to scientifically evaluate the claims made by chemtrail conspiracy theorists. And this is really cool, guys. Here are the results. 76 of the 77 scientists, 98.7% of them, that were part of the study, they claimed that they have not found evidence that chemtrails are real, and that they claimed evidence of chemtrails can be explained with well-understood physics and chemistry associated with aircraft contrails and atmospheric aerosols. The one
what about the other guy?
Yeah, let's talk about that one other guy.
Oh my gosh. The
holdout.
He or she said, this was the other person, they discovered evidence reported that they came across, quote unquote, high levels of atmospheric barium in a remote area with standard low soil barium. Okay, that's, they found a reading that was out of the ordinary, but that doesn't prove...
Yeah,
this grand conspiracy theory under any interpretation, but I will take that as the one person, you know, reserving the ability to say maybe there are chemtrails or not. But the vast majority.
No, but actually, if you read deeper into the study, Jay, they were just saying, yeah, there's high levels of atmospheric barium in remote areas. But then when asked, do you think this is evidence of a secret of slap? They said no. 100% said there's no evidence of slap.
So there you have it.
There it is.
So another thing that happened was all the scientists were shown images of supposed chemtrails. And they all agreed that there was no evidence of chemtrails and all the images could be explained with, simple scientifically plausible explanations. As an example, light refracting through the ice crystals that are left by the jet, you know, the contrail of the jet, those ice crystals would refract light as they go through it and possibly pick up a hue of a different color or reflecting light from a different part of the atmosphere coming from somewhere else, right? That's super plausible, very easy to explain why sometimes you see different colors and it's not them actually seeing chemical inside the contrail. So this study now firmly puts the chemtrail community on the hot seat, because the scientists have given these rational explanations for all of the observable quote-unquote phenomena that are witnessed. The conspiracy theorists, if they don't have better or more compelling explanations than the scientists do, then their claims are now formally disproved. And that's it.
It's also, I like the fact that scientists are publishing in the peer-reviewed literature, smacking down conspiracy theories and pseudoscience. Mm-hmm. Just that fact alone is awesome. Yep.
Yeah, we need more of that.
Yeah, we need a lot more of that.
Yeah, because once they do that, once they draw that line in the sand, it gives a formal reference so new people don't get duped. They have something legitimate to look up and digest.
Okay, let's move on. Kara.
Yes.
You're going to address a very, very common and persistent myth about sugar. Tell us about this.
It's true. So I think most people just assume that if you feed kids sugar, it will make them hyper. This is an age-old question or an age-old kind of truism, a conventional wisdom, as it were. And it reminds me a little bit of the conversations that we've been having recently on the show, like about flossing, or last week we talked about Olympic pseudoscience. And a lot of times when something is conventional wisdom, there's just not a lot of research that covers it because it's just kind of assumed that it's true. I think that the sugar and hyperactivity link fits within that umbrella, but there is some solid research. Now, this isn't a new topic, but it is resurfacing in the media. There was coverage in a Live Science article by Laura Gagel this week, and that kind of piqued my interest. She sort of points to the fact that most of the studies on this topic show that there is actually no link between sugar intake and hyperactivity. But what it really seems to come down to is good old confirmation bias. So, for example, Dr. Mark Woolrake, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, he's the chief of developmental and behavioral pediatrics at Oklahoma University Health Sciences Center. And he's been studying this so-called link or lack thereof since the 1990s. And he himself says researchers simply haven't been able to find it. So here's a quote from him. If a parent believes that sugar affects their children's behavior, their ideas are reinforced by seeing it in those circumstances. And he continues, the body will normally regulate those sugars. If it needs it, it will use the energy. If it doesn't need it, it will convert it to fat for storage. So I think the first thing to remember is basically how metabolism works. And the truth of the matter is our bodies are very good at regulating the different types of nutritive substances that we intake. So if a child, you know, has a normal nutritional amount in their system and then they eat sugar, it's very likely that they'll utilize the sugar that they need as energy, like we've talked about, you know, converting it to ATP, all that good stuff. And that if they don't need it, it will downstream end up being stored as fat. Now, the only time when we might actually see a significant difference in behavior is if somebody is suffering from low blood sugar and they're sluggish. They actually have negative symptoms associated with low blood sugar. Generally speaking, eating food in general, but sometimes that food may be made up of sugar, might be carbohydrate food, could actually affect the behavior, meaning that it brings it back to baseline. But there are some studies that have been done. So one of the earliest ones in the journal Abnormal Child Psychology, all the way back in 1994, actually showed that this confirmation bias is really important in, I think, the societal understanding of sugar ingestion and the interaction of parents with their children and the expectation of hyperactivity. So what they did is they took boys age 5 to 7 and they randomly assigned them to experimental and control groups. They gave the experimental boys sugar and they gave the control boys a placebo. They gave them aspartame, which of course is sweet and tastes like sugar, but doesn't have sugar in it. And then they watched the parents afterward, the mothers and their sons. And they found that there was no significant difference in behavior of the children, but the mothers were actually very different towards the kids who thought that they received sugar. So they tended to be more critical. They tended to interact with their sons more often and to be much more in control. So they actually found that there was a significant difference in the expectation and the action when parents thought their kids had ingested sugar. Another study in the New England Journal of Medicine showed no significant difference between kids that were given sugar and kids that were given controls. This time they were given both saccharin and aspartame. So there are two different negative control groups, and there's no significant difference there. And then later on, that same scientist that I quoted did a meta-analysis, and they were trying to find all of the studies that they could find up to that point that were good, solid studies. And at that point in time, this was in the 90s also, they were only able to find 16 studies that met all of their inclusion criteria. But across these 16 studies, they found that there was no significant difference in behavior or cognitive performance of children who had taken sugar, either in the short term or the long term. So there have been different studies that showed either single doses or kind of controlled diets over a long period of time. I think the question here is, why does this myth persist? And I think the answer is that because we think it's supposed to. And the truth of the matter is, if you've ever been in a situation where you think of kids eating sugar and getting crazy, it's commonly a situation where there's some other variable present, right? It's either that the babysitter is there, the mother-in-law is watching the kids. Maybe it's Halloween. Maybe it's a birthday party where there are a lot of sugary substances that are present. And so we think of those things as being the cause for the hyperactivity in the children, when in actuality, it's just the excitement of change. It's the excitement of a party. And honestly, it's the excitement of putting a whole bunch of kids together in a room and seeing what happens. I also love that one article in a health magazine called Spectator Health in the UK, working on debunking this sugar rush myth. This was published this year, actually, in 2016 in February. The very first comment on this article says, "Great article. If you remain unconvinced, dear parent of toddlers, I suggest you serve nothing but savory low-sugar snacks at your next children's party. Your house will still see the same level of destruction."
Yeah. I've spoken to so many people about this, and they're utterly convinced that sugar makes kids hyperactive, and they have a hard time believing me when I tell them the scientific evidence shows absolutely no causal link there.
Yeah.
You know, if you're not familiar with how powerful confirmation bias can be, it's just hard to imagine. You know, they see the evidence so many times, but it is, I think it's testimony to the power of confirmation bias. Or they're making false assumptions about cause and effect. There may even be an association, because as you said, like birthday parties, et cetera. But even without that, just in day-to-day life, you know, usually the anecdotes they give are just from everyday life. And it's part of it. It's funny how it works sometimes. It's like the kid's acting hyperactive, and then the parent asks, "Oh, did they get any sugar?" And if the answer is yes, that confirms for them that the sugar made them hyperactive. But of course, they don't ask the question, "Did the kid get any sugar if he weren't hyperactive?" So, you know, that's the toupee fallacy, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, they're only asking when they're looking for the positive confirming evidence. They're never asking for the disconfirming evidence. That's all part of confirmation bias as well.
And think about how common these two events that we tend to correlate in our minds are. I mean, eating sugar, which all kids do quite often, and hyperactivity, which all kids are quite often. I mean, these are normal, like you said, everyday occurrences. And it's so much easier, I think, for confirmation bias to take hold when these things are quite common, when this is so socially acceptable, when every single person is talking about it all the time. It's not like the kid's hyperactive and you say, "Oh, did he eat squid today?" You know, which may not be very common in your household. Did sugar?
Did he breathe today?
Like everything. Yeah, exactly. It's like, oh, of course.
Yeah. Must be sugar.
Yep.
Kids find a way to get access to sugar.
You know, it's so true.
They do. And yeah, if you ask about it, the answer is probably going to be yes. When I was, you know, doing some background research for this piece, I looked up the Twinkie defense. Do you guys remember that?
Oh, wait.
Oh, no.
What the hell was
Did somebody
that?
Say no. Their kids ate Twinkies, so that's why they, like,
the Twinkie defense
hurt somebody?
No, this goes back to 1978. Dan White, who is the guy who murdered Harvey Milk.
Remember that?
George Moscone and Harvey Milk.
That sure. I remember.
And he got off on premeditated murder and was convicted of manslaughter. Part of his defense was that he was mentally compromised and therefore not able to perform a truly premeditated act. Now, this is widely reported in the media that the lawyers got him off by saying that he was so hopped up on junk food and sugar that that made him mentally compromised. And that became known as the Twinkie defense.
I love it.
You guys don't remember all this?
Wow. No, I don't remember that.
Oh, my God.
I saw a documentary about Harvey Milk, too.
Yeah. But here's the thing.
Tell me about the Twinkie, Steve.
It's not true. It's a myth. So the actual argument that the lawyers made were that he was depressed, and his major depression is what mentally compromised him. And they offered as evidence that he was depressed changes in his eating habits, that he was relying more on eating junk food. Mm-hmm. So they weren't saying that the junk food made him compromised, just that the junk food was evidence that he was depressed and the depression made him compromised.
Oh, my God.
But the media skipped the middle part there and jumped.
You know, damn you, media.
Yeah, coined the phrase the Twinkie defense, and that, you know.
Gosh. And that's it. That's what stuck.
That's what stuck.
Too late. Yep.
Isn't that funny? I blame Nancy Grace. Yeah. I know that she wasn't on TV Nancy yet, Grace. But I still blame Nancy Grace.
Oh, gosh. Don't get me started on Nancy Grace.
Don't get me started. All right, Bob, but this next item I think you're going to be very interested in. This is about augmented reality.
Yeah, baby.
Yeah, but it's not about the technology itself. It's about the neurological effects of using augmented reality.
Cognitive load.
Yeah, more specifically, the cognitive load, exactly. So the question the researchers had is this. Is using augmented reality in order to perform some task, and the specific case of the study that they did, using an app to navigate around a college campus, right? Because that's researchers and their subjects all live on college campuses, right? So they wanted to know if what would be easier, to hold a phone in your hand and follow it to as a like a GPS guidance system in your smartphone, or to wear an augmented reality glasses and have that guide you through your GPS guidance app. What do you guys think?
Well, with the phone, you can get, it calls out the direction. So you really don't have to look at the phone. You can just listen to what the hell it's saying. I don't know if the AR device can do that.
Yeah, but if you look at people who navigate looking on by foot, your head's down looking at your phone quite often.
Yeah, it is. That's true.
My guess would be that the AR would be a lot easier. I mean, I can imagine that you wouldn't even need constant prompting or even necessarily an arrow always pointing. It would just be the arrow would appear when you need it, and otherwise it's kind of like not even there.
So the answer is it depends. on how the apps function. But what the researchers did was they used a technique called FNIRS or functional near infrared spectroscopy, which is it's a very crude way of just measuring brain activity. And it's portable, so you could essentially like wear it around your head. And it could measure your frontal lobe activity. So what they were doing was measuring frontal lobe activity while students were either following their smartphone app or using augmented reality to navigate around the campus. And what they found was that the augmented reality group actually had lower frontal lobe activity, which is good. That meant it was
cool.
It was less cognitively demanding, probably because, as you say, Bob, you're constantly diverting your attention from the world to your smartphone app, And then changing focus is very cognitively demanding. Whereas with the augmented reality, the two things are merged. So you're not having to shift your attention back and forth. So it was a little bit mentally easier to do that. But that wasn't the only aspect that they were following. The people who were using AR also experienced what the researchers called cognitive tunneling, which basically means that they were a little bit less aware of other aspects of their surrounding.
Ooh.
So while it was easier for them to pay attention to the app, they were also more distracted from things outside of the app, things that the app was not drawing their attention to.
Like bicycle
heading the monkey on the basketball court.
Right, the gorilla with the basketball or whatever. Yeah, so that, that's interesting. that could be a serious problem. You know, when we start to think about what kind of apps are people going to be using with augmented reality, and you know, we already have a problem with people walking out into traffic, texting, and now also like playing Pokemon Go. I don't know if you guys have noticed the increasing number of warnings in the app.
Yes,
about being aware of your surroundings and not.
They don't get their butts sued.
Playing while you're driving and things like that. So attention, I wonder how much of a limitation this ultimately will be on the everyday applications. You know, like Bob, you always have these images of just you just living your life wearing glasses that overlay augmented reality onto reality. And this just becomes the way you interact with the world.
So will compensation for that tunneling be part of future programs for this kind of stuff?
Well, yeah. So, I mean,
that's a good point.
The programs themselves may need to specifically be programmed to compensate for that. But
we clearly need robots to walk on both sides of us and keep us jockeyed in the right position.
I've said before, Jay, that technology, things like, you know, driverless cars or other things may have like drone companions or other things to kind of help it get a better sense of the environment even further around us. I could see that happening. We all have little drones flying around our heads.
This is what I predict is going to happen. Researchers, programmers, you know, will be able to write software that is really intuitive, intelligently designed, that they talk about display symbology, like how are you communicating to the user, and that will be fairly seamless, but that the vast majority of applications will be written by hacks and they will be horrible and the user interface will suck and people will be walking out into traffic. So that's what I think is going to happen because that's what we have today with software. Yes, you have really well-written software that's intuitive and beautifully designed, and you know you flow easily. The cognitive load of using the software is very minimal. A lot of the software, even huge packages. I know I complain all the time about my software at work.
Oh yeah, I was thinking that.
It's so terrible. It's amazing that you have this multi-million-dollar piece of software that's being used in multiple, you know, institutions and around the country, and it sucks. The user interface is so bad. It's so cognitively demanding. I can't even tell you how unnecessarily cognitively demanding this software is.
Multiple times you can't even tell us.
Yeah. So I'm not confident that your average app writer, you know, is going to employ cutting edge user interface technology to optimize display symbology and, you know, not be overly attention grabbing in these augmented reality apps. You know, the standard will be there, but most, I think, applications are going to be mediocre because that's what we got. Yeah, so we kind of have to decide what's going to be the impact of having mediocre applications in your, you know, for augmented reality.
Still, even with those potential problems, Stephen, we've had this discussion before, and I absolutely agree that it's almost impossible to predict how it's going to be used. Like you said in your blog post, actually, that imagine trying to predict the most popular apps 10 years ago. Impossible task. But the fact, I think you could have predicted 10 years ago that smartphones would become the killer tech. And similarly, I predict that augmented reality in one form or another will be the killer technology in the next 10 to 15 years. It's just going to be ubiquitous.
Yeah, and I agree. I think that virtual reality and augmented reality are going to a large part replace our mundane, you know, the normal reality, without a doubt.
Our mundane reality. Ugh, that whole natural reality.
I think it's going to be like microwave ovens, you know, where it's not going to change the way we cook, but it will be an indispensable tool in the niches where it finds its place.
Hey, some people only cook in their microwave oven.
No, come on.
Sure. Some very lonely bachelors only cook in a microwave oven.
Bachelors,
so they are not cooking, they are heating.
reheating.
No, seriously.
I think describing it as a niche, I think, is incorrect. I think these what you call niches, I think, are going to be lots of different niches. The TV niche, the computer monitor niche, you know, the automotive repair niche, you know, the social niche. There's going to be lots of these little niches, And there'll be lots of variation within them, but there'll be lots of them.
Yeah, I agree, probably. But it may not be ubiquitous, as you say. It may not replace your monitor or replace your smartphone. It may be used for certain things in certain situations. Yeah. Because there are things that you can't anticipate, like cognitive load. That's one of those perfect things that no one thinks about that when they're thinking about how cool a technology would be. You know, like, how dangerous is it? How vulnerable does it make you? And it's also just social things, you know. How long did it take for people to invent the word glasshole when Google Glasses came out?
Oh, I forgot about that.
That was nice. I mean, I hear what you're saying, Steve, but when this stuff hits for real, when it has real world advantage, that's it. People are gonna adopt it and never live without it.
Yeah, I agree with that. But what I'm saying is the history of these kind of technologies is that they don't wholesale replace everything else. They replace them partly for things that they do well.
Yeah, it's more of a supplement than anything else.
You know, it's like laptops didn't replace desktops. You know, just.
For a lot of people,
sometimes we use desktops and sometimes we use laptops. Yeah, sometimes
I use both.
Tablets.
I use both.
Tablets didn't replace laptops. You know,
I think a lot of people don't use desktops anymore.
I do.
A lot of people. Well, and same with smartphones. Smartphones replaced a lot of things.
Yeah, but they displaced. They did not replace. So they take their share of the market, but they don't completely eradicate. You know, so there's like I have a desktop, a laptop, a smartphone, and a tablet. I use them in different situations and, you know, for different purposes. No one of them really does everything I need in my computers to do. And I think if I had, you know, augmented reality computer glasses or whatever, that would just be one more device I would add to my growing list of devices, but it wouldn't replace anything, is what I'm saying. Hmm. That makes sense?
Sure. Yeah. You're wrong, but sure.
All right, we'll talk. I mean, I may be. I'm just saying it's really hard to predict. It's really hard.
I'm not predicting.
Well, actually, I did. But I'm just saying. that's the history of technology shows that that's likely. But you do never know. It is hard to say. Digital photography completely replaced film photography, pretty much.
Cars completely took over horse and buggy.
Yeah,
except in mid Pennsylvania.
Yes, exactly.
Right. Aha!
Ah. 'Tis a fine barn you raised there.
And if we've intrigued you, then I recommend you go to audible.com and download Daemon by Daniel Suarez, which deals with a lot of this augmented reality talk.
Yeah.
Look at that.
I will readdress this in 10 years and see who is right.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
Bob, I understand. This doesn't happen every day. I understand scientists are claiming they may have discovered a fifth fundamental force of the universe. Come on.
Yeah, this of course got my attention. I jumped out all over this. So here's the skinny. Researchers have announced that previous research from a Hungarian team of researchers could possibly, maybe, potentially reveal hints of an unknown fifth force in nature that could dramatically change what we know about the universe. So if this, you know, this is exciting with some caveats. If this were true, this would certainly, I think, be a Nobel Prize winning discovery. It would certainly, in my mind, be the science news story of the year, which is saying a lot, especially considering that we detected frickin' gravitational waves earlier this year in 2016. This would be even bigger than that if it comes to pass, which is a big, big if. I mean, this happens often. I've read other potential discoveries of a fifth force, of other particles. I mean, just this week, the LHC did a smackdown on a potential new, you know, unrelated particle discovery that was a blip that turned out to be, you know, just noise. So this stuff happens. So you got to just accept that. But the hubbub regarding this specific one started in 2015 when researchers at the Hungarian Academy of Sciences Institute of Nuclear Research, they released a paper announcing their experimental results that showed what appeared to be an unusual super light subatomic particle being created in their experiments. They blasted lithium-7 with some protons and this thing came out. So the Hungarian team, though, they weren't very sure if this was a matter particle, which in physics parlance is called a fermion. This is like an electron, a proton, etc. Or whether it was a force-carrying particle, which is called a boson. These are the force carriers, photons, gluons, etc. So, but whatever this thing was, it was something that had never been seen before, if it existed. So now most recently, why this is in the news again is because a team of physicists at the University of California, they uploaded a paper to the archive preprint server. Now they've analyzed the Hungarian research and they conclude that more research is warranted. That's the bottom line. Beyond everything else, this warrants more research because they may potentially have actually found a fifth force in nature. So to put that into some context, we've got four known forces: gravity, electromagnetism, strong and a weak force. Technically, though, there's only three forces, since the electromagnetism and the weak force have been shown to be manifestations of a unified electroweak force. But anywho, I just had to throw that in there. So you got the strong force. The force carrier for a strong force is a gluon. For the weak force, it's the Z and Y particles. For electromagnetism, it's the lovely photon. And for the gravity, it's the theorized graviton. So every
Bob,
force.
What about the force?
The force.
Exactly, Bob. Come on.
come on, Bob.
Which has the light side and the dark side.
Surrounds us, binds the galaxy together.
I can feel it.
Then you got to bring in the midichlorians, and that just kind of ruins the whole thing.
Take it easy there.
All right, back to reality, geeks. every force then has a force carrier. You know, without a force carrier, you're pretty much not going to have a force, and that is the boson. So if the researchers have found a new boson, it could very well be associated with a brand new force of nature. So why is this so cool? And do I even have to ask that question? Of course, this would be incredibly cool. Professor of physics and astronomy Jonathan Feng, who did this reanalysis, said the discovery of a possible fifth force would completely change our understanding of the universe, with consequences for the unification of forces and dark matter. Incredibly appealing. So if this discovery is real, it could lead to extensions to the standard model of physics. It wouldn't overturn it, of course. Right. They would just have to add extensions to it that could finally potentially address some of the biggest current mysteries, like dark matter, neutrino masses, the unification of forces. This could potentially shed some light, so to speak, on those major mysteries, which is why this is so incredible. So the question is, all right, and I've kind of alluded to it, how likely is this to be true? Well, not too likely, I'd say. Like I said, we've seen claims for new forces before. They never go anywhere. Also, this is a lightweight particle. It's only 34 times the mass of an electron. So if that's the case, that means we've had the technology to discover this particle or force or boson for decades, yet nobody has discovered this. Why? I know that it's very subtle and the effect is tiny, but still you would think that somebody would have seen it before now. So that's one red flag. There's other red flags, and this one's bigger. Nuclear physicist Oscar Navilliet Kunsick, of Michigan State University, he's looked at this research and he's looked at what this research team has done in the past. And I'll have to say that he's not impressed. He said, it seems that people get excited about it, but do not go and read the Hungarian group's past work. And interesting stuff. For example, the team made sure to thank somebody in their press release. They thanked Dutch physicist Fouke de Boer, but he, however, had a penchant for finding bosons that disappeared in subsequent experiments. At one time, he actually had what he called a pandemonium of more than 10 candidate bosons.
A pandemonium?
A pandemonium, yes.
I wonder if that's what you call a group of bosons.
I think he coined that. This guy clearly, I mean, loves bosons and seems to see them everywhere. And although he wasn't involved in this work, clearly he influenced this group. And Kunsick's sleuthing also revealed that, even more damaging, the team has not reported experiments that did not show hints of a new boson. So that's kind of like cherry picking. That is cherry picking, if true, and that's not the way good experimental science is carried out. So basically, I would say rein in your excitement, but no one will blame you for a little happy dance in the meantime.
Sounds way too premature.
Yeah.
coming from this group with their history, we have to be especially skeptical, it sounds like.
Absolutely.
Jay, get us up to date on Who's That Noisy. You skipped a week, so you got to get us up to date.
Okay, last week I played This Noisy.
You know, people have been criticized and jabbed at and talked about throughout the ages for having different beliefs. And apparently I am no exception. Although it is a constant challenge, I will continue. I will not allow them to stop me.
So, guys, come on. I know you know who that is.
Lady Cleo.
Lady Cleo.
Miss Cleo.
Miss Cleo, Lady Cleo. From the 90s. I think it was the 90s when she had her heyday.
I think it was the 90s or maybe the 80s even.
It was 1997 when...
No way.
Yeah, when she became popular as Miss Cleo. Yeah, so her real name is Uri Del Harris, and she was an actor from California who played Miss Cleo, a Jamaican psychic.
So is the accent to put on?
Oh, totally. Yeah, she was born in California. Yeah, she became famous for her TV commercials for the Psychic Network starting in 97 and lasted a while. And then her life kind of fell apart, and you know, people kind of realized that she wasn't legit. She was also on like other TV shows and stuff like that as an actress and a comedian. But sadly, she died this year in July from colon cancer. She was 53 years old.
Oh, so young.
Yeah, so we had Rich Regalado. Rich Regalado, who guessed first. Thank you for sending that in, Rich.
What do you got for this week?
So this week...
Here it comes.
What is that?
I don't know.
Sounds like an ignition, maybe, of some sort?
One hint, you needed to hear the whole thing.
That's a good hint.
And this was sent in by a listener named Tim Dodd. Thanks, Tim. That's a cool noisy. I want everyone to give me a guess. Send your guess and any cool noisies you heard this week to WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
All right. Thanks, Shay. Kara, what's the word this week?
The word this week is flocculation.
Ooh.
Ooh, it doesn't sound good. We don't like that one. Flocculation.
Sounds like a dirty word.
It does sound kind of dirty. flocculation is the production of flocules, or flock, which are woolly, downy, or fluffy masses from a colloidal suspension. So that means that the individual particles within the suspension aren't actually fully in solution like a traditional solution. They're actually still suspended in there. So it's a little bit different from precipitation in that way. Flocculation is actually a clarifying process that's necessary for water purification. But specifically, this week, the word flocculation was recommended by listener Adam Baring, who reached out via Facebook. He says that he learned the word from home beer brewing, but in the brewing process, flocculation actually has a slightly different meaning. So I looked on some like brewing blogs and learned what I could. Apparently in brewing, there are three core processes. There's pitching, attenuation, and flocculation. Pitching is the addition of yeast to wort to start the fermentation process. Attenuation is the amount of sugar that yeast consumes during fermentation. And flocculation is the process by which the yeast itself comes together and then drops to the bottom of the fermenter. So in that way, it's a little bit similar, but it doesn't come out as flocules. I found some more info. Most, quote, wild yeast doesn't flocculate well and tends to remain in suspension for too long a period of time. So brewers over history have continuously collected yeast from the bottom and the top of their fermenters, and in doing that have artificially selected for more flocculent strains that are better for beer brewing. I thought that was pretty interesting. The noun flocculation was first coined in 1875, and it comes from the root flocculate. That verb comes from the Latin flocculus, meaning flock of wool, because it looks like wool.
Cool. That is one of those words that you could sound like a lot of different things if you just use it in a certain way. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Like, oh, you've got a really flocculent rash here.
You know? And the funny thing is, you could potentially be describing like woolly or kind of downy masses. Like if somebody had a rash that had fluffy looking masses, it'd probably be, you know, reasonable to call it a flocculent rash.
Fuck you.
Jay likes to flocculate when he's alone. It's a perfectly cromulent word.
It really is.
It really is now.
Yeah.
Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about our ad this week, Audible Audiobooks.
Guys, if you haven't signed up, you really got to sign up. I just finished War Factory by Neil Asher's awesome AI story, and I'm in the middle of Robot Uprisings. It's a bunch of different authors, bunch of different narrators, all with a common theme of robots and AIs taking over, and it's just wonderful.
And if you're not into sci-fi or fantasy, I know, blasphemy. There are still thousands, literally thousands of books to choose from, mysteries, thrillers, memoirs, even bestsellers. You can download your books or your shows to your mobile device, and you can listen anytime, anywhere. And guys, the app makes listening so easy because you've got chapter navigation, narration speed control, and you can even share your favorite audio excerpts with your friends.
You can access your books, your shows, all your stuff anytime, anywhere you want, right from your smartphone or your tablet or any other device.
Join Audible today and explore the world's leading provider of audiobooks. They're all incredibly performed by talented actors and narrators.
You can start your 30-day trial and download your first audiobook for free. Go to audible.com/skeptics to get started. That's audible.com/skeptics for a free 30-day trial and free audiobook. All right, guys. Well, let's go on with our interview. We are joined now by Fraser Cain. Fraser, welcome back to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thanks for having me.
Fraser.
So, Fraser, you are the head honcho at Universe Today. What's your official title there?
I am the publisher of Universe Today.
The publisher.
The head honcho publisher.
Right.
It's good work you're doing, Fraser.
That's exactly right. The big cheese. That's right. That's right. There are towering Universe Today offices on my kitchen table. As I work alone in my in my laptop, I have that sign emblazoned over top. But no, we got a great team. I mean, you know all the writers that we have, and they're located all around the world. But we operate out of here on Vancouver Island.
Yeah, you're a virtual organization.
Exactly.
Just like pretty much everything that we do.
Yeah.
So no brick and mortar anymore, just virtual.
Except for the cool studio in your basement.
That's true. I do have a cool studio in my basement.
Yes, you do. Mm-hmm.
So, Fraser, we wanted to bring you on the show tonight, and thanks for jumping on such short notice. We wanted to talk about this new alleged discovery of an exoplanet around Proxima Centauri. Tell us about that.
I'm glad I'm on the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, because I'm going to have a very skeptical but hopeful report to make, which is that Der Spiegel, the fairly solid German newspaper, is reporting, about half a week ago, that the La Silla Observatory in Chile has detected a rocky world in the habitable zone of Proxima Centauri. And of course, Proxima Centauri is the closest star to the sun. It's only 4.25 light years away. So if true, this is incredibly exciting. This would be the closest exoplanet pretty much that's possible. Right? You know, there are no closer stars. Yeah. So this is it. This is the one.
Well, a rogue planet. But I guess so.
Yeah, the rogue planet, the one that's not careening through the solar system right now.
No Goldilocks zone for that.
Yeah,
thing,
yeah. But this is rumor and speculation in that it's an anonymous source within the discovery team. The European Southern Observatory is declining to confirm or deny that this thing exists and this is happening, and that apparently we're going to have to wait until the end of the month for some kind of confirmation. And it doesn't surprise me, because this is the same team that turned up planet orbiting Alpha Centauri a couple of years ago. And then it turned out that there was sort of mistakes in the noise, and the planet went away again. So I think whoever's working on this, they're being incredibly careful to make sure they got all of their data correct before they go and make this announcement.
Right. They don't want another, well, I guess an embarrassment as they had before. So that makes sense.
But one of their team went ahead and leaked it. Good work.
Yeah.
Something's wrong, right?
This is it. And, you know, we dug hard. I mean, we really tried to find anyone else who'd talk about it, anyone else who had any other information. And it was, you know, I guess ISA went on to pretty full lockdown mode. They've said they're not going to confirm or deny. You know, we've talked to a bunch of other people that are kind of interested in it, but nobody else has any more data. So this is all we've got.
Yeah, but it seems as if, you know, because the ESA is a respectable organization. If there were nothing to this, they would just deny it, right?
Well, so, and that's exactly it. And, you know, we had an article
saying we're not going to confirm or deny is kind of like, you know, we're probably going to announce confirming. Something.
Stay tuned. Yeah, stay tuned for our official announcement.
When they have something to deny, they send you an email and they say, you wrote a story and you made it up. Please take it down. It's not real. Now, that's never happened to us, but I'm anticipating that day if it ever does happen. That's how they would do it. So nobody's told us to take our story down. Nobody's told, you know, Der Spiegel's story is still up. So I guess the damage is done from the leak side, and we're waiting to hear the actual details.
So do we know who actually leaked it?
Someone on the team is all we know, but it's an anonymous
source. Do you know
source.
When you can't say it, you don't know?
I don't know, no. I don't.
You come on. You could tell us.
I, if I knew, I would tell you. Okay. But I don't know, which is what I would also say if I did know and couldn't tell you.
Right.
Even if it's real and there is a planet and it's an Earth mass planet and it's orbiting within the habitable zone of Proxima Centauri, it's exciting because it's a close planet. But it's not that exciting because, you know, these red dwarf stars are pretty dangerous places, especially in the sort of first few billion years or so, because they have a very fiery, very unstable sort of environment. And they've been known to blast out these really powerful flares that could very well scour any planet that's there of life. So if it was a world there, I wouldn't want to live there.
So therefore the term Goldilocks zone not applicable in a case like this, or do these red dwarfs still have a Goldilocks zone?
They absolutely have a Goldilocks zone. It's very small because, I mean, the amount of energy that's coming out of one of these red dwarf stars is very low. And so the habitable zone, the Goldilocks zone, is also very small. At the same time, though, you know, and so you could have liquid water, completely irradiated liquid water, that's constantly being blasted by solar winds and really mega, mega flares. So it's just it's not a great place to live.
Are all red dwarfs prone to mega flares?
It's one of the things that happens in the earlier phases of their development. So assuming a red dwarf star can survive that, or, you know, not assuming, I mean, the red dwarf stars, they sip at their hydrogen fuels. They'll last billions, even trillions of years. So, but if a planet can make it through that first few, that first early period where they're very unstable and very, fiery, then it's actually a pretty great place for life, because then you've got really literally trillions of years to settle down and live out the rest of your time. But it's that first period when we know life was forming here on Earth that it would just be completely uninhabitable because the star itself is really trying to kill you more than normal.
Yeah, but so what? I mean, so after it calms down, then life can still develop. I mean, there's no reason to think that there's a window where life can develop and then that window closes, right?
Yeah, well, the question is, what impact will these stars have with the radiation and the volatiles on the planet and things like that? So this is still a point of contention among astronomers. If you ask them, you know, I ask this question all the time. If you talk to them 2-3 years ago, it was just like, no, they're dead places. You don't want to go anywhere near them. I think in the last couple of years, people have been coming up with some simulations, especially things that involve the movement of planets. So over time, you can have gas giants and things like that actually shift the position within the solar system. So you can have this really great situation where maybe you have an icy world that forms out further away from the star, out of the danger zone, and then through interactions with the other worlds, it sort of makes its way closer and migrates into the inner solar system, into that habitable zone after the star has already calmed down. And then you've got a really great situation.
It's also true, though, that with the smaller stars, like the red dwarfs, the habitable zone, in that zone, planets are likely to be tidally locked, correct?
Yeah. So Tidally Locked, of course, is the situation where the interactions between the star and the planet sort of grab these handles of gravity on both sides of it and just force one of the sides to face the star. And this is, of course, what's happened with the moon. And this is what happens with all of the large moons in the solar system to their respective planets. You know, all the large moons of Jupiter are tidally locked, same with Saturn. And so that's the same situation that you would get with one of these red dwarf stars. And once again, not a great place to live on. But still, you know, along the edges, you might get this situation where, it's still habitable and it's got that trillion years to work out an ecosystem that can thrive in that.
Right. So if it is tidally locked, there might be a habitable zone on the planet itself, like the ring around the equator where it's not too hot, not too cold.
Right? Yeah. Or underground. I mean, again, mm-hmm. you know, give it a trillion years and see what it comes up with.
And even if they didn't spawn life, you know, the question, of course, is would this be a planet that we would want to colonize? So how close is Proxima Centauri? It's the closest star to us.
Yeah, it's 4.2.
Still damn far away.
Yeah, it's 4.25 light years away, which is ridiculously far, right? So, like, to take the Voyager mm-hmm. spacecraft, you'd be looking at 100,000 years to make that journey.
We could use a wafer satellite, though, and get there in, like, 20 years.
Yeah, we sure can. And really should. Now, this is the Starshot idea, right? These really yeah. tiny chip-sized satellites that are, you know, they have some kind of solar sail and they're zapped with a laser. I call it, you know, getting bug zapped. And then they get shot towards, say, Proxima Centauri or Alpha Centauri. And it's a great idea in theory because you could, you know, if you have a light enough spacecraft, you could accelerate it to a significant portion of the speed of light. You could be going, you know, 10% the speed of light, and it would just zip past this, you know, make the distance in just whatever, 40 years. That's not so bad. There are some downsides, though, which is like what happens to a spacecraft going 10% the speed of light as it's moving through the interstellar medium. It's like a sandblaster at almost, you know, at 10% the speed of light. So that could be catastrophic. These chips are going to, you know, these spacecraft are going to be very small. So how can they communicate back to us? Because communication requires, you know, a large transmitter. So there's a lot of challenges with that idea of technology. The best way is to just be patient, you know, just give yourself the 100,000 years to make the journey.
Well, it's not going, you know, the star's not going anywhere.
Yeah. Don't, yeah. Well, yeah. And we know the planet, if it's there, is going to be there for trillions of years. So don't worry about it.
And that's not fast enough for any time dilation effect. So it would be 100,000 year ship time, basically.
Yeah. There's no way you're not going to time dilate any of that away.
But of course, the problem there is, you know, you'll get, you know, 500 or 600 years out, and then the spacecraft that we're building 600 years from now will just fly by you.
Yeah, it'll pass you, and then it'll fly past them. And then
warp drive.
And the warp drive.
I hate when that happens.
And the people will be waiting because they use the Stargate. Yeah, no, it's not a good
thing. Stargate, I love that show.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, that technology of the Starshot, I love it, but I love it more as a way to explore the solar system. Because
exactly,
you know, you could make these tiny little spacecraft. You could zap them around the solar system. You could build this array of lasers all around the solar system to even like change their directions. And then like you could go out to Pluto maybe in a couple of months or weeks, wow. as opposed to taking the 10 years that it took New Horizons. So even though this technology is being bandied about as the way to get to other star systems, I really am fascinated about it as a way to get around in our own solar system. And I really hope that more development goes into this.
Absolutely. I talked about it just a few months ago. And the other huge plus you can get from such a powerful orbiting laser system is asteroid mitigation.
Yeah. And you get more of that infrastructure in the solar system and it just becomes, you don't have to carry your fuel and you just have to align yourself with this laser array. And then you get to get a boost over towards the Jovian orbit. And then you catch the solar array that's, you know, near Saturn and it sends you off to Pluto. Like it feels like a
it's
way
like a relay.
That humanity, yeah. Relay. It feels like a way Relays. That humanity will get to become a true solar system civilization. So, you know, when people kind of dismiss it as a way to get to other stars, I think it's going to really have its power in the solar system.
Sure. And it's not just, it's not so much pie in the sky as you may think. I mean, as I said in my talk, I mean, we've made advances in lasers in the past 10 years that make this technology feasible today. I mean, and it's totally scalable. You just make it bigger and bigger and then use it for, you know, longer distances, shorter, transit times, bigger asteroids. I mean, if I was a trillionaire, I would definitely dump, you know, $100 billion into something like that.
That sounds great. I wish you will. And I think, you know, people should donate to the Skeptics Guide. They should join your Insiders Club. And then some of that money will go to Bob, and then he'll be able to fund our future space array.
Sweet. You are so positive.
Totally reasonable.
But I'd like to point out we are not guaranteeing that we will build lasers with our SGU membership money, but we will talk about what it would be like to build lasers. We will do that.
We'll write some fan fiction. It sounds great.
Now, Fraser, can these lasers be used as weapons? Is that like a legitimate concern? Filling the solar system with these powerful mega lasers.
Yeah, and how? Yeah. I mean, you know, a laser that's capable of generating that kind of a pulse and a kick to a spacecraft will then kick it up to a significant fraction of the speed of light would also, you know, give you a bad day if you were close. But, you know, I haven't done the math on the attenuation and the distance and the, you know, how far the energy would fall off over time. But maybe that's a future blog post. Could the Starshot space array kill us all?
Or could it defend us from invading aliens?
The aliens will never see that coming.
No,
like, no way. No.
Come on. Just the fact that they got here would mean they would step on us no matter what we had.
But then they'd be like, wait a minute, their propulsion lasers are aiming towards us, Captain.
All right, well, Fraser, this has been a lot of fun. Thanks for coming on the show with us.
Always a pleasure. Keep looking up.
All right.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. Then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake. There is a theme. The theme is technology. Here we are. Item number one. A new study finds that users ignore security warning messages up to 87% of the time, depending on when those messages appear. Item number two, in a recent survey, female students aged 18 to 29 reported sending and receiving an average of 265 texts per day, which they report made them feel more connected to family and friends. And item number three, scientists have developed a new form of cuprate with the highest temperature superconductivity to date at negative 30 degrees Celsius, edging closer to the ultimate goal of room temperature superconductivity.
Ooh.
Kara, you uttered, so you get to go first.
I can't help it. That one got me excited. I hope it's fact. Users ignore security warning messages up to 87% of the time, depending on when those messages appear. Well, that has a lot of caveats in it, doesn't it? I'm assuming that's users of like a laptop or something.
Yeah,
or
computer.
Your phone.
Computer,
yeah, okay. In a recent survey, female students aged 18 to 29 reported sending and receiving an average of 265 texts a day. That sounds reasonable to me. It seems a little high for me. I'm probably like in the 90s, maybe. I don't know, actually. I've never looked at my text records. They made them feel more connected, family and friends. Yeah, of course. So the only reason I think that one would be fiction is if I'm off by the number, if it's more like 95 texts a day instead of 265 or 65 or something. Scientists have developed a new form of cuprate. I'm assuming that's like copper or something.
It's a good assumption.
Yeah, with the highest temperature superconductivity to date at negative 30 Celsius. So that's still really cold and really frozen, but it's getting closer. That's why it says edging. I didn't realize it was a lot colder than that still. I guess it is. Crap, these all seem like they could be science. But I'm going to say that users ignoring their security warning messages is the fiction.
Okay, Bob.
Let's see. 80% of the security things. Yeah, that actually seems kind of reasonable to me. I see so many security messages. Well, maybe not necessarily security, but just other error things. I guess you could ignore what I just said because it's not security. But but yeah, I mean, I could say, like, especially like I go by my mom. I know she's not representative, but she's just like totally oblivious to what any of that stuff means. But I could see it being that high, actually. The texting 265, that does seem a little high, but then again, we are talking about 18 to 29 year olds. I consider myself a big texter, but that seems like a lot, but I don't think that's extraordinarily too high for that age group. And, the coup rates, minus 30 Celsius. I mean, you know, I haven't been tracking this that closely, but last I heard, I mean, they were still down at liquid nitrogen temperatures, which was a huge advance. And, you know, they've made, you know, increases since then, but nothing significant. And minus 30 would be a hell of a bump as far as I can remember. That would actually be awesome. Too good, actually. That would be a major, major, advance. So I'm going to say that one is fiction.
Okay, Jay.
The one about people ignoring 87% of the security messages. I mean, I could see that. I think people get a lot, you know, I don't know. There's not enough detail here, but they could be getting, you know, just minor threat warnings from internet activity and things like that. So, you know, it's roughly 8.5 to 9 ignores per threat, per message, right? Okay. You know what I'm saying?
It's one of my favorite punk rock bands, Jay.
That's right.
Minor threat.
I don't want that to be true. I would hope people would be smarter and safer than that. But okay, I do think that's probably what the average user is doing. This one about the students, female students, 18 to 29, sending 265 texts per day. So this wouldn't surprise me. I could see, you know, it's a tricky one because they're saying, you know, it's a student 18 to 29. You think, you know, they have more free time and they're communicating with a lot of friends and family. 265 texts, not a lot if you think about it. In an average text message, you know, if you chat with someone for a half an hour, your text messages number goes crazy. Who the hell knows here, but my gut's telling me that one's true as well. So this last one about the superconductivity, you know, getting closer to room temperature, this one does seem too good to be true. And I think I'm going to say that this one's the fake.
And Evan.
I'll agree with the guys. I think it's Cooperate one is going to turn out to be the fiction.
Okay.
Oh, no.
Yeah, Cooper pairs, baby.
All out on your own. But we'll start with number two, since you guys all think that one is science. In a recent survey, female students aged 18 to 29 reported sending and receiving an average of 265 texts per day, which they report made them feel more connected to family and friends. You all think that one is science, and that one is science.
Yeah, baby.
Yep.
I have absolutely no problem believing that one, given the behavior of my two daughters.
And they're not even 18 yet.
Yeah, I mean, Julia especially is like constantly texting her friends, constantly, all day.
Oh, my God.
She's got her that phone, and it's like, you know, it's hard to get her to put it down at dinner, and it's just, you know, that's how they connect. That is how they network. It's just all, and they, texting is absolutely the preferred communication. Even like email, like they don't even want to email each other. You know, like that's too much work. You know, just they like the instant evaporative communication, you know.
I can relate to that. I mean, we've got emailing at work. I mean, who doesn't have emailing at work? But
is work.
Yeah, to a certain extent.
It is.
But the thing is about, we have Skype as well. We've got Skype at work. So if you want to ping somebody, it's basically texting, and that's so much more convenient. It's quicker.
All right. So the same survey looked at male students as well. So for the female students, they said they averaged 365 minutes a day of using their cell phone, sending and receiving an average of 265 texts and making and receiving 6 calls per day. What about the male students? What do you think the numbers are? Higher, lower?
Lower. If not the same.
Lower, I would think.
Lower,
I'd
say. Lower, 287 minutes, 190 texts, but also the same amount of calls, about 6 calls. So they're males and females are calling the same, but the female students were texting.
A lot more.
Yeah, a lot more. 265 per day versus 190. But here's another interesting difference is that the male students did not report that texting made them feel more connected to family and friends. But the female students felt it did make them feel more connected.
Hmm.
I think that has nothing – that has less to do with texting and more to do with maleness.
Yeah.
I mean, I like texting, but I don't feel more connected. It's just
I just think you – I bet you do. You're just socialized not to say you do.
Okay.
I really do. I would really posit that it's just culturally, that's not something a guy says.
I disagree.
That our description of feeling connected is very similar to yours. We're just, it's more acceptable for us to say it.
Well, I think I'm being honest and not just a slave to some to social convention.
It's very hard not to be.
Well, this study did not explore that question, but it is interesting. Yeah, cool. Okay, let's move on. We'll go back to number one.
No.
Doesn't matter at this point, Kara. Seriously.
Kind of does.
A new study finds that users ignore security warning messages up to 87% of the time, depending on when those messages appear. Kara thinks this one is the fiction. The guys think this one is science. And this one is science.
Yeah.
Sorry, Kara.
All right.
Yeah, this is not surprising. People basically ignore those pop-up security warnings when they occur.
So annoying.
But the study was really focusing on was when they occur.
Always at the worst time.
Yeah, exactly. This gets back to the cognitive distraction, right? The cognitive load. There's a specific phenomenon known as dual task interference, which basically, whenever you have people do two things at the same time, even if they're both super easy, their performance takes a nosedive. That's why people can't multitask. That's the bottom line. So there's a lot of research looking at what happens to someone's performance when you introduce a distraction. But this study kind of flips it. They're looking at how much people pay attention to the distraction when they're performing a task. Because that the distraction is a security warning that pops up on your computer. So the more engaged people are with doing specific tasks, the more likely they were to completely ignore the warning. So for example, if you are closing out a window in Google Chrome, when the message appears, you know, then there was an 87% probability that you would ignore it. If you were just watching a video, 79% chance that you would ignore it.
So that would apply to porn?
Porn, they didn't specifically test porn. I would imagine that would be even higher.
Yeah, well, think of it. No, maybe not, Steve, because think about it. I mean, a lot of those porn sites are, they're just riddled with malware and nasty shit.
How do you know that, Bob?
Jeff, I've done a lot of you know,
reading
research on this stuff.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think they might take them even more seriously, because if you're going to get a nasty, you know, virus, you're going to get it on a porn site.
Mm-hmm.
So just saying.
My two cents.
So pretty much speaks for itself, Bob. All right. But the good news is that this research, and they actually were like measuring fMRI of people's brains when they were doing this too, not just like their subjective reports.
And fMRI studies.
So when the warning messages crop up during another task, it does cause this dual task interference. It actually dramatically increases cognitive load. So again, the good news is they could use this research to time when these messages appear, so that you're more likely to pay attention to them. Like, for example, they talked about, programming the browser so that browser warnings won't crop up if you're using the mouse at that moment, you know, so it'll wait until your mouse activity decreases before they decide to pop up a message. And I wonder, again, like how tweaked that could get. And they've gave this information to Google, and they were very interested in incorporating it into Google Chrome. You know, they were saying that, oh, this could, you know, help us, you know, improve functionality so people actually pay attention to those security warnings that we keep throwing in their face. You guys tell me what you think. I find that this is one of the greatest frustrations of using any software, is that it pops things up in your way when you're trying to do something. And it seem to be totally at the wrong time and very inconvenient. It's like, just get out of my freaking way so I can do what I'm trying to do.
Yeah, or a modal window will open up or something that stops you from activity.
Yeah.
Maybe I have a pop-up blocker. I feel like maybe that's a difference, again, between Windows and Mac. But, like, I don't ever get pop-ups. Like, it's just really rare that I get any of my software programs telling me something, unless it's like, your trial period has expired. You can't use this software anymore. Or, you know, whatever the case may be. I don't get security pop-ups.
Hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe it's a Mac thing.
Could be.
You got to surf more porn.
or
what'd you say?
Or anything that steals your focus, right, is incredibly annoying.
Evan, what did Bob say?
You have to surf more porn.
Yeah.
But you do that on your computer, not your phone? Come on, amateur.
Phone? Little tiny screen, give me a break. I need high res, baby.
VR.
Wouldn't you rather be in bed? I'm confused. Plus, you have Hi-Res on your iPhone.
Yeah, but it's a tiny screen, so it's almost irrelevant.
Well, that'll
you
be...
need to get a 6 Plus.
That'll work well.
I do.
The 6 Plus is not a tiny screen. It's like a little laptop in your hand.
Plus, you need your hands-free.
Yeah, but right, exactly. Where's the hands-free out? You need to mount a screen above your bed is what you
need.
You
only need one hand-free.
It is big, but compared to a laptop, all right, I've said too much.
All right.
You're not doing it right, Kara.
10
all right.
minutes ago.
As have I. We have different requirements.
All of this means... Other than Bob needs a girlfriend, seriously, but all this means that
what? Seriously?
Scientists
Another
have
girlfriend.
Developed a new form of cuprate with the highest temperature superconductivity to date at negative 30 degrees Celsius, edging closer to the ultimate goal of room temperature superconductivity is fiction.
Oh, gosh.
What so do fiction. You guys think is the current record for the highest temperature superconductivity?
Minus 70. Mike, 150, I think.
140.
Minus 70.
Really?
Yes.
Total guess. Celsius?
Celsius. Whoa. Minus 70 Celsius.
That's actually a surprise.
Cuprates actually had the record for a long time, but it was recently broken by a material called hydrogen sulfide.
Hydrogen.
Whose critical temperature reaches negative 70 degrees.
Isn't that the stinky
Celsius.
Egg smell?
Now, what the news item, which has nothing to do with raising the temperature, but that inspired this was about researchers looking at why high temperature superconductivity exists. In other words, what is it about the medium? And they were looking at cuprates. Like what is it about cuprates that allows them to have relatively high temperature superconductivity?
Hydrogen sulfide, rotten egg odor.
It is hydrogen sulfide.
Come on, you punk.
It is?
Yes. I knew it.
Well, I guess rotten eggs are superconducting.
That's weird.
They used to think that what made these cuprates high temperature superconductive was how tightly bound the electron pairs were. But this new research suggests that it's actually the density of the electron pairs per unit area. So like mm-hmm. the more electron pairs you have,
the lower the temperature.
The higher the temperature at which you still have superconductivity. Yeah.
Lower the number.
Yeah. While you're in the negatives, until you flip to positive. But yeah. But negative 70, that's getting pretty good. They just,
once you
creep over zero, doesn't have to be literally room temperature, but once you creep over zero, now you're talking about just, ice cooling is enough to get to superconductivity. That, really starts to open up possibilities for applications,
Geez, 86. Was the big breakthrough.
We were promised so many things back
then. It
in the
was 80s, pathetic. Oh, 86. I'm thinking, man, in 5 years we'll have room temperature superconducting wires. And it was still,
you are a techno optimist, Bob. I keep telling you.
I don't disagree.
It wasn't just the optimism. They didn't really tell us like how hard and far off it was.
No, they were hyping it. That's what they do. There was this breakthrough in superconductivity, high temperature superconductivity, and then they just shamelessly extrapolated to, if we keep making progress at this rate, without considering that we have no freaking idea what hurdles are going to be between now and room temperature superconductivity. Here we are 30 years later.
Right.
We're at negative 70, which is impressive, but we're, who knows? It could be another 30 years before we eco to 0 degrees.
It's like battery
and it's
technology.
It's not just the hurdles. I mean, it took until this year for them to figure out what makes a material a higher temperature. I mean, this is how many years since then? So that's a key bit of information. But I might argue, of course, that now that we know that, it's an important discovery, though. It's important.
Yeah, it could be. We'll have to see. Hopefully it will, you'll be able to use that information. But again, they always say that with this information, we'll be able to whatever, cure the common cold or it's like one of those things,
Yeah.
But you don't know. You don't know if this will lead
you
to some
never,
application.
You know.
Yeah. All right. Good job, guys.
Thank you.
Kara, better luck next week.
Yeah. you've beaten us before too, so.
Evan, give us the quote this week.
All right, I'm going to read this as if I think it should be read, but I haven't seen the episode of from which it comes, so you'll have to let me know how it goes, okay? I need skeptical, clever, critical. Skeptical and critical, remember? Be strong, even if it breaks your heart. How's that?
Good enough.
Spoken by Doctor Who.
No, spoken by the Doctor.
Oh, sorry.
Not Doctor spoken. Who.
Okay, I'm just reading the text you
Doctor
sent.
Who's the name of the show?
I understand that. I'm reading The Doctor. The episode was named Dark Water. See, I got the episode right. And this particular doctor was Peter Capaldi.
Yeah, who's the current doctor, number 12, I believe.
Dr. 12.
Who I really like. I think he's been great as the doctor.
He's doing a good job?
He's doing a good job. The writing is still needs to improve. You know, his first season was horrible.
Rough.
And then
horrible.
Got better last season, but I'd love to see
him improve
some more.
It only get better if it was horrible.
Oh, there were some episodes that were just horrific. The moon
was
an egg of a dragon. I mean, it was just horrible. Like, what?
What the hell? I don't understand that. What? Why
because they have different writers, but they don't
different
have
people come in and go. The writing staff isn't, it's not the same person writing every episode.
Doctor Who receives 89% on Rotten Tomatoes, by the way. So
that's very
good. People like it.
Yeah, it's very, very good. I love it. I mean, when it's good, it's awesome. And when it's bad, it's campy, and you kind of still enjoy it.
But anytime the doctor mentions the word skeptical, you know, gotta have it, gotta use it in the show.
Yeah. No, the doctor is a great hero character. Because he doesn't even carry a weapon. He's totally nonviolent. He solves problems entirely with his mind, with knowledge. And it's also, I mean, yeah, sometimes he invokes, like, he just happens to have some particular piece of arcane knowledge from, because he's so old or whatever. But often it's just, he's just using a lot of logic and common sense and observation. He is very much like a Sherlock Holmesian kind of character where at the end he tells you how he had to figure it out all along and how he had to know, you know, what was going on. And when it works, it's really, really good. Very enjoyable.
Okay.
Good science geek nerd science fiction show.
Solid. I'm sure we'll be seeing some of it when we are at Dragon Con.
I'm sure we will. Yeah, that's right. We're going to be at Dragon Con over Labor Day weekend. If you are going to be there, check us out. We're going to be doing a live show, a panel. Basically, it's our live show. We'll also be doing a private show. So you could talk to us about that. And we'll have a table. We'll be selling some swag. And we'll be hanging out, geeking out like everybody else. It'll
absolutely
be a lot of fun.
Absolutely. Yep.
Awesome. Some of us,
yep.
Some of us may be in costumes some of the time. Right, Kara?
Perhaps.
Some of us may not.
I'll be showing up in a costume I've never worn before. I'll be surprising everybody.
Some of us might just be naked in our hotel room.
Yeah,
also crying. Fun, I guess.
All right, guys. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Sure, thank you, Steve. The doctor.
Steve. Thank you, Steve, Doctor Who.
The doctor.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.